and curator Southeast European collections at the British Library. Welcome all. It is wonderful to welcome you in the British Library. Thank you very much for coming. I'm delighted to introduce the British historian, Professor Sir Hugh Strong, and the Serbian writer, Aleksandar Gatalica, as our distinguished panel speakers this evening on the subject of the First World War and its legacy in Britain and the Balkans. Professor Sir Hugh Strong has been Chichell Professor of the History of War at the University of Oxford and a Fellow of All Souls College since 2002, and was Director of the Oxford Programme on the Changing Character of War between 2003 and 2012. He also serves on the Strategic Advisory Panel of the Chief of Defence Staff and the UK Defence Academy Advisory Board, as well as being a trustee of the Imperial War Museum, a Commonwealth War Graves Commissioner, and member of both the UK and Scottish committees for the centenary of the First World War. He sits on the Council of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, and since 2010 has been a specialist advisor, the Joint Parliamentary Committee on the National Security Strategy. He's a fellow of Corpus Christi College, Cambridge, was elected a fellow of the Royal Society of Edinburgh in 2003, was awarded an honorary doctorate by the University of Paisley in 2005. In 2010, he chaired the task force on the implementation of the Armed Forces Covenant for the Prime Minister. In 2011, he was the inaugural Humanities Visiting Professor in War Studies at the University of Cambridge. He is Brigadier in the Queen's Bodyguard for Scotland, Royal Company of Archers. In December 2012, Foreign Policy magazine included him in its list of top global thinkers for the year. He was knighted in 2013, New Year's Honours List, and was appointed Lord Lieutenant of Tweedale in 2014. Some of his recent books are To Arms, 2001, the first of three volumes on the First World War, The First World War, A New Illustrated History, 2003, derived from the Channel 4 series of the same name and retransmitted in 2014 by the BBC. Karl von Clausewitz on War, A Biography, 2007, The Direction of War, 2013, and as a joint editor, The Changing Character of War, 2011, How Fighting Ends, A History of Surrender, 2012, and British Generals and Blair's Wars in 2013. Our second panel speaker, Aleksandar Gatalica, was born in Belgrade, where he graduated from the Department of General Literature and Classical Humanities Faculty of Philology. Has published 5 novels and 5 collections of stories. His best known and award-winning novels are The Lines of Life, 1993, The Invisible, in 2008, and The Great War, in 2013. His best known collections of stories are Mimicries, in 1996, Century, 101 History of a Century, in 1999. Gatalica translates from ancient Greek and has published translations of Aeschylus, Prometheus Bound, Sophocles' King Oedipus, and for the first time into Serbian, Euripides' plays Aklisthesis, Iphigenia, Aeolus, and Bacchae, as well as the last play by Sophocles, Oedipus at Colonus. Gatalica is active as a music critic and writer, has written music criticism for several radio programs and daily newspapers. As a music writer, he has published 6 books, among others Rubinstein versus Horowitz, 1999, and The Golden Age of Pianism, 2002. Gatalica is the editor of numerous anthologies in Serbian and other languages. is represented in more than 20 anthologies of Serbian short stories translated into foreign languages, and contributes to numerous foreign magazines and compiles entries on contemporary Serbian literature for several foreign encyclopedias. I'm also pleased to introduce our co-organizer this evening. Istros Books is a London-based independent publishing house at the forefront of discovering and promoting literature from Southeast Europe. Amongst their list are the works of the leading philosopher Slavoj Žižek, the Albanian writer and political activist Fatos Lubonja, and many other leading names in contemporary literature from the region. Istros Books have no less than 5 EU Prize for Literature winners on their list, representing authors from Montenegro, Serbia, Slovenia, and Turkey. Having won successful grants bids from, among others, the European Union Culture Fund, English Pen and Arts Council England, Istros Books provides a secure platform for some of the best literature from the region to reach a new audience of English-speaking readers across the globe. The Great War by Alexander Gatalitsas, Istros' 20th and most ambitious title to date. The English translation is by Will Firth, and signed copies of the book are available today at a special price of £10. In the dispute between the Austro-Hungarian monarchy and the Kingdom of Serbia during the July crisis, Britain was advocating peace in Europe. After the Austro-Hungarian ultimatum to Serbia, a British proposal for mediation was rejected by Germany. Following the declaration of war on Serbia, Britain was still keen on mediation and to this end was ready to accept the Austro-Hungarian occupation of Belgrade and other places in Serbia. Until the very end of the July crisis, Britain did not commit to her allies, France and Russia, in her effort to preserve the peace in Europe. Britain had no direct interest in Serbia, and the British public became aware of the gravity of the situation only after the Austro-Hungarian declaration of war. Britain was less concerned about Austro-Hungarian hegemony in the Balkans than about German hegemony in the war. And in the end, Britain went to war to defend Belgium and to support France. In 1914-1915, Britain tried unsuccessfully to form a new Balkan League, an alliance of Romania, Bulgaria, Greece, Serbia, and Montenegro. Britain expected Serbia to make sacrifices by offering to Bulgaria the territories in southern Macedonia acquired in the First Balkan War, so-called uncontested zone in Macedonia. The British policy supported Bulgarian claims in Macedonia on ethnic grounds, and British sympathies for Bulgaria were expressed as late as 1918. The British belief was that a Balkan alliance would bring victory in the war, which would enable Serbia to acquire, in exchange for the territories in Macedonia, to acquire Bosnia and Herzegovina, Serbian areas of Slavonia, and part of Dalmatia with access to the sea, and possibly Croatia should the Croats freely choose union with the Serbs. Serbia was unwilling to secede most of the uncontested zone of Macedonia to Bulgaria in exchange for new western territories, including access to the sea. Romania prize for entering the war in August 1916 included the whole of the Austro-Hungarian Banat. Greece didn't go to war before June 1917, when the Entente allies removed the king who advocated neutrality until then. The drawing of Italy into the war involved South Slav populated territories along the eastern coast of the Adriatic. According to the Treaty of London of April 1915, Italy was to receive Austrian Istria, the northern part of Dalmatia, and most of its islands. Contrary to this design, the declaration of Corfu, proclaimed by the Serbian government and the Yugoslav Committee in July 1917, called for the unity of all South Slavs and for the Adriatic to be a free and open sea. British politicians, however, were unwilling to consider the South Slav propositions or to give guarantees of support for Yugoslav Union until the very end of the war. The evolution in British policy towards the right to self-determination occurred in spring of 1918. Our key questions this evening include: how did First World War begin, and why were Britain and the Balkans drawn into it? Was the Balkan front pointless from the British perspective? What are British and Balkan traditions of the war? What are contemporary interpretations of the First World War? What is the legacy of the First World War? And how is the war commemorated in Britain and the Balkans? What don't we know about the First World War? So, Sergio, if you like to start and give us your introduction,
be great. And that would it be good if I just start with the causes rather than anywhere else?
Of course.
Grounds we want to proceed logically, having given us an enormous agenda. What Milan said, that Britain enters this war ultimately because of Belgium and events in Western Europe, I think is indisputable. And certainly, Frederick Grey, throughout the July crisis, was anxious to keep his cards as close to his chest as he possibly could, in the hope that he would help. This is the positive interpretation of Grey. There are those who see him as more malevolent, in the hope that he could encourage both France and Russia from overtly and premature action. In other words, rather, he felt a strong support for either of them would actually make the crisis worse. Others have argued, of course, that if he'd given strong support to France and to Russia, then that would have deterred the Central Powers in the first place. There might not have been a war. So this argument can clearly go both ways. His concern, too, we'll have to remember his domestic position. His concern, too, was that the bulk of the British public, right up until the German invasion of Belgium, were deeply divided about the wisdom of entering this war. And not only the British public, but the British press. The Guardian remained, Manchester Guardian as it was then, remained strongly opposed to the war until the very end. And those who, within the cabinet would have split. The Liberal government would have fallen before the invasion of Belgium. It's the invasion of Belgium that brings all these competing interests to an end, and essentially means that simultaneously the war can be seen as a great moral cause. It can fit into a Gladstonian liberal rhetoric that this is about the rights of small nations and the rights of people of neutral states not to be attacked. It's that Belgium, of course, also provides a strategic justification for Britain, precisely because it is adjacent to the Channel and to Britain's maritime, imperial and global communications. So why does Serbia matter in all that? And the answer is in part, of course, that at times Grey suggested it didn't matter. And indeed, at the beginning of the crisis, there was a somewhat petulant reaction in London, which was, you know, more trouble in Serbia, we can do without this, and if only we could drag the problem out into the Adriatic and leave it there. I think this was a Grey reaction or a Guardian reaction, then that would be very helpful for the peace of Europe. This, in a way, underestimates what I think is a more can be seen as a more active British role in the Balkans in the lead-up to the outbreak of the war, and I would stress just two points. The first goes back to December 1912, the First Balkan War, a moment when it seemed as though either Austria-Hungary or Russia, or both of them, might be motivated to intervene. And a moment, too, when there was a test of the fragility of the relationship between Austria-Hungary and Russia. In 1908-1909, Austria-Hungary had annexed Bosnia-Herzegovina, had done that, it thought, with the tacit agreement of Russia, and then found itself shocked and surprised when Russia had reacted very strongly against that. The Russian foreign minister, Izvolsky, found himself out of office, and the Tsar found himself running with the current, a very strong pan-Slav enthusiasm. And what that meant in relation to the Balkans was that tensions within the Balkans would now be exploited, possibly, by both Austria-Hungary and Russia, rather than managed by the two great powers that both had an interest in this. And when you combine the 1912 crisis with the fact that it is directed initially by the Balkan states against the Ottoman Empire, which is the third, in inverted commas, great power with an interest in the Balkans, then you have a situation where the Balkan states have become even more powerful than they have been since 1878, an ability to essentially manipulate great powers and to control them and even to provoke them into action. And Gray's concern in December 1912 was that Russia would indeed support Serbia, that if Russia did so, that could well provoke Austria-Hungary, and that if that were to happen, two things would follow. The first is that France would support Russia because the alliance had been reaffirmed by French President Raymond Poincaré, and that Germany would support Austria-Hungary. And Gray issued a warning to the effect that if that were to happen, if Germany were to support Austria-Hungary in the Balkans, then Britain would be unlikely to stand aside. So for many, this is, if you like, a premonition, a prior working of the July crisis itself, which essentially is configured on very similar lines to the crisis of December 1912. And the Kaiser was so furious that he convened what has been called a war council, not really that organised, in the sense that the German Chancellor, Terbold von Bethmann-Hollweg, wasn't there, didn't attend it, it was simply his military chiefs. And what we forget about this crisis, which again is seen as a prefiguring of the outbreak of the First World War, because at the meeting, the chief of the German General Staff, Helmut von Moltke the Elder, said, the sooner war comes, the better, according to one of the records kept of the crisis. And Tirpitz, the head of the Imperial Naval Office, said, not just yet, thank you very much, the Navy will be ready for war in 18 months' time, which of course gets us conveniently to June 1914. The Kaiser is not actually responding to the situation in the Balkans, he's responding to his outrage that Britain has presumed to express a view about the situation in the Balkans. And until very recently, particularly in the hands of Fritz Fischer, the German historian, with the notion that the causes of the First World War are to be understood over the long term, rather than just in terms of the July crisis. That linking of the First Balkan War to the July crisis, that linking of the Balkans to a wider European context, has been seen as absolutely anticipating what was to come in July 1914. And I dwell on it just because what it highlights is the notion that Britain is reluctantly drawn into this war in July 1914 and only enters because of Belgium, which, broadly speaking, I think in relation to the July crisis is accurate and fair, needs to be tempered by the recognition that Britain has actually had a strong view in relation to the Balkans, which is if the Balkans does trigger the alliances into an involvement into what would now otherwise be a local war, then Britain is likely to find itself drawn in. That is the view that Gray has expressed in December 1912 as Foreign Secretary. The other point I would make, which follows directly from that, is the position that leaves Austria-Hungary. What seems to me very striking in the July crisis is that Gray, we were talking about this at the conference on Gray, which the Foreign Office organised on Friday, that Gray constantly sees Austria-Hungary as incapable of making its own foreign policy. He sees Vienna as prompted by Berlin. He sees Germany as the figure behind Vienna that is pulling the strings. And he cannot believe in July 1914, when Austria-Hungary issues its ultimatum to Serbia, that it is doing so without the strong support of Berlin. Well, it's true that Berlin has given the blank check, so-called, to Austria-Hungary. It is said it will cover Austria-Hungary's back. But Germany has done remarkably little after the beginning of the July crisis in the run-up to the Austro-Hungarian ultimatum to Serbia. It is actually, indeed, many in Berlin said, this will be like every other crisis in the Balkans, nothing will happen. And Eric von Falkenhayn, the Minister of War, tells Helmut von Moltke, the younger, the Chief of the General Staff, who is taking the waters in, where is it, in Carlsbad, I think, don't hurry back, because all this will blow over. Nothing will happen of any great significance. Go on taking the cure, having your holiday, and it'll all... and it'll back. It won't. Nothing will happen, because he feels that Austria-Hungary will back down. And in the event, of course, Austria-Hungary does not back down. And the reason that Austria-Hungary does not back down is that when Sir Edward Grey, in late July, proposes that there be a peace initiative, that the great powers sit down and talk about the possibility of resolving this crisis, in other words, he reinvokes the concert of Europe and of 1815, the idea that rather than have war, we should be able to talk about these problems around the table. When he does that, Vienna has decided before the crisis that it has no interest in that. It has no interest in the concept of Europe any longer, because what have the great powers done from the Congress of Berlin in 1878 onwards? What they've done, as they would see it, is support the Balkan states in particular as they have emerged, enable them to grow. Serbia in particular, of course, is growing at Austria-Hungary's expense, at the expense of the Habsburg Empire. And so whereas in 1815 this system was created very largely by Austria through Metternich in order to keep stability within the international system, Austria-Hungary, despite being an empire seemingly in decline, no longer has an interest in a system which actually doesn't preserve the Habsburg Empire any longer. So for Austria-Hungary, this is a moment to act, to go to war. For me, this is very much a crisis that is driven by Austria-Hungary. We've got the paper record. We don't know the full workings within Serbia. But we know the workings in Austria-Hungary. It wants a limited local war. It does want to defeat Serbia. It wants to use the assassination as the excuse to do that. And the problem for Britain is that Britain would also dearly love this to remain a limited local war. And indeed, so would Germany. But it isn't what's going to happen. Precisely because that scenario of December 1912 gets triggered. I can go on talking about other things, but I think that might be... do we want to talk about July 1914 to begin with, or would you like to carry on and say one or two other things about why I think...
That would be great.
You tell me to shut up.
No.
Well, let me move on from the July crisis and how I see that to... where I think Britain's next crucial role in the Balkans comes, and that is in 1915 itself. When the war breaks out, those powers that enter it immediately and quickly explain what they're doing as a war of national self-defence. And indeed, of the original belligerents, the only state that is not directly attacked is Britain itself. Gilbert Murray, the proposer, really, of international coordination and peace, a great advocate of the League of Nations movement, says in October 1914, and he uses a phrase that is now only too familiar in Britain, this is a war of choice. We had a choice to stay out of this war. That is not true for Serbia, self-evidently. It is not true for Russia, which sees itself as attacked in 1914. Germany is attacked on its eastern front by Russia, and on its western front by France, and self-evidently France and Belgium are attacked. But having got this war, what then seems, between two evenly matched alliances, what seems vital is to get other countries into this war, because, so the argument runs, one more country could swing the balance, could change the story, particularly when statesmen realise that this war is going to go on for a long time. The generals know that pretty well from the beginning, but the statesmen take time to wake up. And when they go into 1915, where are the obvious potential new belligerents? And the answer is they're in southern and southeastern Europe. They are the other Balkan states. They are Italy, which of course has stayed out until May 1915. And so there's frenetic bidding in 1915 to persuade Greece, Bulgaria and Romania in particular to enter this war. And what is interesting about what is on offer then is that this, the reasons that during the course of 1915, of those three countries, putting Italy to one side, only Bulgaria will enter the war, and the other two, as Milan said, will enter Romania in 1916. Bulgaria will enter on the side of the Central Powers. Romania will enter in 1916 on the side of the Entente. And Greece, the Allies, of course, the Entente powers keep very quiet about this, but if they can accuse Germany of infringing Belgian neutrality, Britain and France certainly infringed Greek neutrality in 1917. But they cite all sorts of spurious excuses to justify their action, to make quite sure that they aren't compared with Germany, and on the whole, they aren't. But those three countries are hedging their bets. They look at the Battle of the Marne, they realise Germany's not going to achieve a quick victory. They look at the situation on the Eastern Front, because clearly their proximity, particularly Romania's proximity to the Eastern Front, will affect the military situation when they do decide to enter the war. And those that are but the sea, of course, particularly Greece, look very carefully at Britain because of British sea power and the effect of that in the Mediterranean. So they're playing a much more, in inverted commas, strategic game than are the great powers who go to war in July, August 1914, if you like, in a more paroxysmic, is there an adjective from paroxysm, way. And that, what that means is that their reasons for going into this war turn out to be very different too. They absolutely set down territorial war aims. What are they trying to achieve? Where will the frontiers of Bulgaria be defined? This is the agenda of the first two Balkan Wars repeated. It is a Balkan War, and people have called it the Third Balkan War, it is the Third Balkan War carried on in sequence and a slightly different timing from the First World War. And those ambitions are very local. They are not to be defined as some of the big ideas which are now motivating the belligerents of July, August 1914, who say they are fighting for the rights of small nations, for the rule of law, for culture, for civilization, for all sorts of universal values. These states are defining their ambitions in much more pragmatic terms. And of course, a bidding war goes on. Who can offer most from one side or the other to satisfy those aims, and at whose expense will the land be offered? So clearly Britain can't offer land that will be at Serbia's expense, but can offer land that might be at the expense of Austria-Hungary, or after September 1915 when Bulgaria enters the war, at Bulgaria's expense. And that is in my eyes, a very different sort of war. It's a sort of sub-war within the wider war. I think one of the ways of viewing the First World War is as a series of regional conflicts, and in many ways this is a Balkan regional conflict. In 1918, at the beginning of 1918, with the three Balkan powers having entered the war, apart from Serbia obviously, but with Bulgaria having entered 1915, Romania in 1916, and then Greece in 1917. By the beginning of 1918, Austria-Hungary has won its war. And we tend to forget that because Serbia is overrun in 1915. The British and French support for Serbia is too late, partly because Britain, of course, has got sidetracked to Gallipoli. The troops that might have gone in to support Serbia in 1915 are not delivered there, they're delivered to Gallipoli, and one of the reasons they're delivered to Gallipoli is Churchill is persuaded briefly that Venizelos, in and out of office as the Greek Prime Minister, will deliver a Greek army of 300,000 men, not a British force that will actually do the attacking if there has to be a land operation on the Straits. So Gallipoli is itself part of the Balkan conflict. So Serbia is not supported by Britain or by France until it's too late. Serbia is, as I'm sure you all know, largely overrun. The army is evacuated and through Corfu and ends up being landed in 1916 in Macedonia. Another infringement, if you like, of Greek neutrality. And so Austria-Hungary has achieved its war aim, its initial war aim, with German help. In Romania, Romania enters the war thinking it's timed it right at the end of 1916. In fact, it's timed it catastrophically badly, and it is defeated very quickly by the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians. And the consequence of that is, although Romania continues fighting, and people tend to forget this, into 1918, the Treaty of Bucharest does actually mean that Romania is, and the oil that it contains within it, is essentially being partitioned and broken up. And that means that, again, Austria-Hungary has delivered on its war aim then. And there, and then, of course, the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk and the defeat of Russia after the revolution. Again, all if you look at the position in the spring of 1918, why should Austria-Hungary carry on this war? It's a satiated power. What is interesting is what then happens, because Austria-Hungary, given the chance to negotiate a separate peace in 1917, doesn't take it. And having achieved what it has got, doesn't then also take the opportunity to get out of the war while the going is good, and instead feels honour bound to go down with Germany. And the consequence of that is that, of course, the Allies have to rethink their own position in relation to Austria-Hungary. Milan mentioned just now that it's only very late in the spring of 1918 that Britain agrees to the partitioning of Austria-Hungary, which, of course, is what is going to give many Balkan states, as well as many other Central and East European states, both further territory and, in many cases, national identities. Why does it do that? It does that because of its allies, primarily. Britain wanted to leave a powerful Austro-Hungarian state in place at the end of the First World War. He had no interest, despite having underestimated Austria-Hungary in 1914, at least Sir Robert Grey having underestimated it. Britain had no interest in destroying Austria-Hungary in 1918, because it felt that if Austria-Hungary were partitioned, German Austria would in due course be folded within the German Empire. And therefore the problems of Germany within Europe would be amplified rather than diminished. So the British policy, until the and Balfour in particular is very strong on this, the British policy is that it changes for, I suppose, two big reasons. The first, perhaps three, depends how many I get to. One big reason is Italy. For Italy, the defeat of Austria-Hungary and what happens, of course, to Slovenia in particular, is of central importance. That has been promised under the Treaty of London. Italy's focus is very much on achieving its objectives in the Balkans and on the Dalmatian coastline. And that implies the dismantling of the empire. And indeed it is from there that the propaganda offensive for the Austro-Hungarian army is generated, from Italy. And the other reason is the United States. Woodrow Wilson has listened to the exile communities of the Austro-Hungarian Empire who are in the United States, particularly Poles and Czechs, essentially a bidding war emerges in terms of who is ready to give those states a separate identity. But if you know the 14 points, you will know that one of the 14 points that Woodrow Wilson enunciates in January 1918 is the principle of national self-determination, which essentially implies the ending of the empire and indeed a reconfiguring of the Balkans. Of course, is what, in a way, means that Austria-Hungary has to carry on fighting. Once that commitment is made, the empire is doomed unless it comes out on the victorious side. And the final point I would make about the Balkans and Britain is this. If you read any of the current British narratives in relation to the war, those who argue for the generals, I'm not going to, let's not have any discussion about lions and donkeys this evening, but those who argue for the generals would talk quite reasonably about the performance of the British Army in the last 100 days on the Western Front. And they will talk about the defeat of the German Army in the field. On the 29th of September 1918, just after the British and the French and the American armies, because the British narrative, of course, forgets there are two other armies fighting on the Western Front, had broken the Hindenburg line and was pushing the Germans back, just after that, Erich Ludendorff, the first quartermaster general, convened a conference of the German general staff and said, we must seek a surrender. And the assembled German staff officers were amazed, and they said, but we're they may have broken through on the Hindenburg line, but we can hold. The army is still intact in the field. We can fight defensively in the west. And he said, it's not that. It is that the Serbs, the British and the French, under French commander-in-chief, Franciszek Desperi, have broken through in Macedonia, and Bulgaria has sought an armistice. The war, the argument runs, begins to end here in the Balkans rather than begins to end on the Western Front. Now, that's a contentious argument, but what Ludendorff is saying is that as a result of the collapse of the Balkan Front, that the Allies will push through, get into Austria-Hungary from the south, expose the southern front, which Germany itself cannot possibly hope to hold, and therefore the war will be lost by 1919. Max von Bayern, the new German chancellor, says, but exactly as many of the generals have said, we could hold out. But by then, armistice negotiations have been begun, which shows the power of the Supreme Command, the OHL, the German military Supreme Command, but that's the case. And when Ludendorff himself pulls back from the armistice thought and says we can carry on fighting after all, it's too late. So the argument, one argument, and a sustainable argument, is that not only does the war begin in the Balkans, it also ends in the Balkans.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Alexander, would you like to tell us how Serbia went to war?
Yes, I want to say thank you to Sir Hugh first for a wonderful introduction and the words we may be and the sentence we know perfectly, but it is good to hear it again in one place in a way we can understand what happens in First World War in Europe and in the Balkans. Milan and I told how to divide that matter, and I prepared to you one article I written for this June for one political and historical weekly magazine, NIN. So it is translated in English, and I read it to you now. It is not that long, and speak about history and about so-called small person, the average man, about the way of thinking, and of course about the June and July crisis in Serbia. History is the teacher of life, but history is not interested in the individual unless he has been chosen by the era in which he lives to represent the many. But what about those invisible people who from those years the often mentioned little people? They are not the subject of history, for they cannot be. History contains the big events, establish the charts, plans, and influence the experience of the creators of those events through the decades and centuries. But it cannot perceive the vast fields of human hopes, prejudice, false conceptions, and above all, the resolute human desire for survival, which makes every critical event ephemeral and normal at the time when people live through it. This is what history says. On the 28th June 1914, Gavrilo Princip killed the Archduke Ferdinand and his wife Sofia in Sarajevo. This did provoke a change of events which led inevitably to the war, which was called first of all the European War, then the Great War, and finally the First World War. History goes on to tell us, after weeks of waiting and feverish diplomatic activity, on the 23rd July, Austro-Hungarian, through its ambassador in Belgrade, Baron Gislingen, sent a note and ultimatum to the Serbian government, and not satisfied with the reply it received, on the 25th of July, at 6 o'clock and 15 minutes in the evening, broke off diplomatic relations with Serbia. 3 days later, on the 28th July, Austro-Hungary declared war on Serbia. It first sent its rivers gunboats to shell Serbian towns on the bank of the Danube, causing the inhabitants of Belgrade, Smederevo, Golubac and other places to flee. This action was followed by the frontal offensive on the 12th of August. It's 30th July, it's according to old calendar of 1914, which held it at the beginning of the greatest conflict in the date in the history of mankind in 20th century. But what was happening during the days which were not marked with the red pen on the war calendar? People, like today and like always, were living and hope. They were saying there is not going to be war, the Jewish will pull back, they'll be afraid of Russia. And then they said there'll be an ultimatum, there won't be an ultimatum. The ultimatum has just been written, the ultimatum has been written, but not with what won't be delivered. The life of the ordinary man in the street is known to us all here and there in Belgrade. After the 28th June 1914, there followed the 29th, 30th, and 1st July. People woke up, went to the market, bought, as today, their greens, papers, and tomatoes. A journalist writing for Belgrade's main daily newspaper, Politica, noted during those days, the market has everything. So far, example, wonderful tomatoes cost 5 or 10 para, it is more like pennies. And for 16 or 20 huge yellow bell peppers, you pay 1 grout. Only melons haven't yet arrived. This was the journalist wrote for Politica. And how to combine what history writes with how people lived? History says the war had to happen because the conditions for it were known and determined in advance. The little people in 1914 were not aware of this. If they lived in Belgrade, Šabac, Loznica, or in any of newly liberated territories in the south in the First and Second Balkan War, they were aware that they had just gone through two hard, bitter, glorious, and sad years of the Balkan Wars in 1912 and 1913. During those years, their country became for the first time, my country, Serbia, for the first time a regional power, even extending for a short period down to the Union Sea. The men in the street always clinging the good news and in no way resembles the journalist for whom only bad news is a good news. In the Balkan War, the Serbs first defeated the Turks with the Bulgarians and the rest of allies, and then, from the Serbian perspective of the time, the always treacherous Bulgarians in the Second Balkan War. Anyone who felt himself to be a gentleman of Belgrade, going out each morning to the barbers for a shave and to read the newspapers, smoothed his silver moustache with a sense of satisfaction. This respected citizen thought a better time, is coming for Serbia, a time to take pride when we'll take to the international political stage, when the efforts of old and young nations like Serbia will make this one the best of all centuries, the 20th century. Even if it isn't the best of all centuries, at least after 1914, everyone will have to ask Serbia what is going to happen in Balkans, in the Balkans. Then came the murder in Sarajevo, as we know. Should the cause our proud reader of the daily newspaper to hesitate? Not at all. It's just one day, the 28th June, so what? Let's now imagine that the man we are following is a merchant and that his business has doubled since Serbia in 1914 has grown by 1 million inhabitants. He writes that some young boy of whom he has never heard killed an Austro-Hungarian prince, Franz Ferdinand, and his princess Sophia. And what does he do? He turns the page to see the adverts. Because assassination of kings and princes have happened before in 19th and 20th century, and he is just a merchant and he has to earn his for his living. So he read the adverts on page 4 of his newspaper. We can even quote these adverts. In his grocery shop, Trandafil Lazaridis sell real Turkish delight from Istanbul with or without almonds. Order can be taken on telephone number 1181. It is original address for Politico of that time. Imported shoe polish, the best for perceiving leather, Idealin, is for sale. You can also buy the ideal hair color in the Persian, produced by the pharmacy to the royal Kurt Kushakovich, and the soap called Narcissus from the beautician Okanovic. And if anyone felt like dying, in the days following the 28th June, there is an advert for a first-class funeral parlor, Petar A. Popovic, with a very realistic drawing of a luxury funeral coach pulled by a highly decorated horse depicted on the advert itself. Our merchant gets up. Should we stop him here in front of the cafe, the Serbian crown? Should we tell him there's going to be a huge war? There will be terrible losses. The countries of Serbia will be ruined. And in a year's time, the army accompanied by civilians with their children will have to retreat across Albania. If we were to stop him, we can be sure that he would just laugh, wave his hand and go on his way. If he was in a good mood or if he was in a bad mood, he would call police to have us arrested on the spot for spreading panic and false news. But time march on. Things get really complicated. The newspaper add to the sense of impending ruin. However, according to what we can read in them, people do not believe that war is coming. Haven't we also seen something like this on the day when a more recent attack on Belgrade began? The writer of these lines, that is me, was absolutely convinced that it would not be happening. And sent his child to her ballet class and was planned for this day. He took her home to the sound of sirens. In the same way, the inhabitants of the city in 1914, when equally convinced that there would not be the war, someone will prevent it. The web of intrigue is beyond the comprehension of ordinary men. And those who can see further will find a way to stop the plot unfolding. The newspapers at that time wrote, "Are we looking at the crime after the assassination of Archduke? Are we looking at the crime committed by anarchists? The Freemason and are financing the anarchists and even choosing their victims. Could they be mixed up in this murder? The religious feeling of Archduke Ferdinand are well known, and the Catholic Church has his full support. Is it not possible that the International Masonic Society wanted to prevent his taking the throne at any costs? This is confirmed by the fact that the killer also shot the Archduchess Sophia, who, it is said, exerted a strong influence on her, Catholic influence on his, on her husband. That was Politica was writing in 1940. Someone will somehow resolve it, that believe our ordinary citizen. Our merchant, whose turnover has increased in the newly liberated territories in today's Macedonia and part of Albania, will not have to die because of their conspiracy. His children do not have to die too. Therefore, he will return to his shop and trade. His children will travel, and he will plan, like the good father he is, to send them to Vienna for their education. But no one will go to Vienna, and nor will anyone begin their studies there for a long time after 1914. Anyway, why should an ordinary man concern himself over that? Let's see if there will be a note from Austria-Hungary. Of course, the note arrived. Relations with Austria-Hungary were broken off. War was declared, and history says, but even then, the people of Belgrade did not believe that there would be a real war until the very end, until the very last day. The big guns of the Austrian artillery shelled Belgrade from Danube, but the inhabitants remained in the capital city, behaved as if they were not worried. The newspapers, reliable sources of everyday information, on the eve of the great conflict wrote, the famous actor of Belgrade, Ilija Stanojević, arrived at the building of National Theatre in Belgrade, which had been hit. He pointed at something with his finger and explained, they have hit the window of the third balcony because they are bankrupt and don't have money to buy a ticket for a box. They did not even have money for the balcony, so they came and hit the building in a matinee, which is obvious that they have that they came for a matinee performance because, as you know, it is much cheaper. And so history, and with it the little people, arrived at the Battle of Mountain Cer and River of Drina. History does not lie. It just contains all days which are not specially marked on the calendar of time. It was there, on 12th August, in the Battle of Cer, as history says, that the children of the merchant we have been following became aware that they will be war. There will be war. At the moment, the man in the street became a man of history, but there is absolutely no need to congratulate him for that. He was much more interesting when he was ordinary. We need literature, therefore, alongside the history, in order for us to see him, to paint him with the colors of life, and to take a note of his experience. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alexander. We heard about historical and political perspectives and the life of ordinary citizens and ordinary people in Serbia and the Balkans that didn't really differ much from the life of a British citizen here. Now I'd like to open a discussion and to invite you to ask questions or to say your opinions and thoughts. This is really now your debate. So please, you, sir, please.
Sir Hugh.
Yes.
Just the relationship of Britain and Greece, if I might. It's interesting that you mentioned that Britain wanted to recruit nations in order to fight. It did this in Greece, but it had given British nationality quite a few local Greeks in the Ionian Islands. Mm. Who then joined and fought in Gallipoli, including my grandfather.
Right, there we go. Yeah.
The fact whether Greece is Belgian, I'm not too sure, but there were already a sort of civil war between the Greeks here in Britain. Mm. or the foundation of modern Greek studies at the King's College. The Venizelis coming over here, Venizelis splitting up Greece. And therefore, can we actually compare Greece with Belgium, that, since there were shenanigans going on both amongst the Greeks here and
I mean, you're absolutely right, of course, about the deep division within Greece as to whether or not they should be in the war and whose side they should be on. And of course, the prevailing narrative would be that the king, especially, being a Hohenzollern, was keen to side with the Central Powers. An argument, I have to say, I find it difficult to buy into. I mean, I think the king is simply being prudent and staying out of the war. But that for Venizelis, of course, is not an acceptable position to be adopting, and particularly, of course, those who are supporting the idea of a greater Greece. I mean, Serbia is an expanding power in 1912-1914. Greece, too, of course, has ambitions looking eastwards. And those tensions within Greece do put it in a different position from Belgium. Of course, you're right about that. What I referred to, in part, is the sensitivity that Britain and France both feel in 1917 themselves. I mean, the neutrality of Greece has been breached at three different points in the war, really. One is with the attack on Gallipoli itself anyway, because of the issue of which islands will be used as bases for the Gallipoli expedition and whether they would be Greek islands or not. One is is then the landing of Salonika and the use of Salonika essentially as an Allied enclave in sustaining the Balkan War against the Central Powers. And then finally the landing by French Fusilier Marin in 1917, which results in French troops entering Athens, and in 1917. And so all those are areas where they could feel compromised. And you're absolutely right that there are plenty of Greeks who welcome this and who would support it. But the issue here is, are you dealing with the sovereign state and its frontiers? And in that case, the sovereign state has not actually reached a decision to enter the war. So that's the sensitivity. But I entirely accept that it's not quite the same as Belgium, and that there are deep divisions within Greece as to where it should be and how it should be behaving. I didn't realise there were Greeks who had joined and fought at Gallipoli, so I'm intrigued to know about your grandfather, you said. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. When Britain left Corfu in 1864, it gave a number of people the right to be British,
Right. But does that mean that, so you're from a Corfitt family originally? Yeah.
And
so that's the sequence.
Together with other Corfitts.
Yes, please.
I'm more interested also in the history of Serbia. You spoke of the two wars they had had. Were they a territory of Austria-Hungary? Why did Austria-Hungary want to go to war and invade Serbia? What was their history at all? We talk about them declaring war on Serbia, but what was their purpose? Did they have a history of territory in previously?
You're speaking about territories in Macedonia after the increasing the Serbia after the second Balkan War?
Yes. Why was Austria-Hungary so threatened by and wanted to invade Serbia?
You know, you ask writer, not historian. To my opinion, Serbia consider to be a country with a local influence. We often call regional force. And it was the plan of Serbia since 1903, and changed the dynasties, as you may know. We assassinated the Obrenović and finished with the Obrenović dynasty and turned to Karađorđević dynasty. And when Karađorđević dynasty came to throne in 1903, obviously there was a plan that Serbia became a regional force. The problem, it is often in history, because we were late. We cannot make regional force in 20th century. The Serbia maybe, if we prepare to speak about parallel history, which is not which is a slippery to speak of that. Maybe Serbia could do it in 19th century, but not in 20th century. In 20th century, it was a completely different situation, and